Mahabharata Chapter 24 Yudhisthira's Moral Instructions. When Krishna heard the news that the Pandavas had been exiled, he decided to go and see them in the forest. He invited Balaram, Drishtadyumna, Sikandi, and many other kings to accompany him, along with Subhadra and her son, and together they rode to the Kamyaka forest. Seeing Yudhisthira and his brothers dressed in deerskins and stripped of their kingdom, both Balaram and Krishna were enraged. Krishna said, "I cannot tolerate this injustice. The earth shall drink the blood of Duryodhan, Karna, Shakuni, and that fourth one, Dushasan. After we kill them and their followers, we will install Dharmaraj on the throne. Those cunning men deserve to be slain. This is quite in accord with the eternal morality." Krishna's anger blazed. It seemed as if he were about to consume the creation. Arjuna quickly sought to pacify him by recollecting his many wonderful deeds. "O Krishna, the great Rishi Vyasadeva has told me that you are the cause of creation, the mover of all minds, and the beginning and end of all things. All asceticism rests in you, who are the embodiment of all sacrifice and the eternal supreme person. All the gods depend on you, and you are the origin of the universal creator, Brahma. O mighty-armed Keshava, you have appeared many times on earth in different incarnations." Accepting Krishna as the cause of even the almighty Vishnu, Arjuna described the various Vishnu avatars who had appeared in past ages. "O Krishna, as Nrsinga, you slew the mighty Asura Hiranyakashipu. As Aditi's son Vamana, you span the entire universe with three steps. O soul of all beings, covering the heavens, you dwell in the body of the sun and imbue him with your own effulgence." Arjuna went on to describe Krishna's activities in his present appearance. "You have killed numerous demoniac kings who were fierce enemies of even the gods. O Janardhan, you have manifest here on earth the sacred and eternal city of Dwarka, which abounds in opulence and is always crowded with rishis. Envy, untruth, malice, and cruelty are absent in you, who are always the well-wishing friend of all creatures. Narada has told me that at the end of the yuga, all things, mobile and immobile, will enter your body. O Krishna, there is no limit to your glories. I have spoken of only a minute part." As he spoke, Arjuna felt himself becoming overpowered by transcendental ecstasy. His voice choked up and he was unable to continue. Pleased and pacified by Arjuna's expression of love, Krishna said, "You are mine and I am yours. All that is mine is yours. He who hates you also hates me, and he who follows you also follows me. Formerly you were Nara and I was Narayan. Though individuals, we are as one. No one can understand our oneness and difference." Draupadi, her dark beauty enhanced by her soft deerskin clothes, came forward with folded palms and said to Krishna, "O irrepressible one, all the great rishis have described you as the supreme person. The entire universe exists in you, and you are the refuge of all ascetics and sages. Even as children sport with their toys, so do you sport with the celestials. Those seeking your protection are never overcome by calamity. O slayer of demons, how is it that one like me, the wife of the Pandavas, the sister of Drishtadyumna, and your friend, could have been so insulted by the Kauravas?" Draupadi's dark eyes filled with tears as she spoke. Subhadra also wept as she stood with her arm around Draupadi's shoulder. As she recalled the dice game, Draupadi became angry. "Why, O Krishna, did my five powerful husbands sit silently while I was humiliated by wicked men of no importance? Fie upon Bhima's arms and Arjuna's celebrated Gandiva, for they could not protect a woman in distress, not even their wife. Fie upon Bhishma and Dhritarashtra, although I am their daughter-in-law, they were prepared to see me as a slave." Draupadi hid her face with her soft hands, which resembled lotus buds. Her shoulders shook as she cried. Regaining her composure after a few moments, she took a deep breath and concluded, "O Krishna, you are my only shelter. I deserve your protection for four reasons: due to our family relationship, our friendship, the respect you bear for me, and the fact that you are my Lord." Krishna replied, "O fair lady, you will see the wives of those with whom you are angry weep as you now weep when their husbands lie dead on the battlefield, their bodies covered with arrows and weltering in blood. Do not grieve. I shall do for the Pandavas whatever lies within my power. You shall be the queen of kings. I speak the truth. The heavens may fall and the Himalayas move. The earth may be rent and the ocean dry up. But know for certain, O Draupadi, my words will never prove false." Draupadi was solaced by Krishna's words. She did not doubt that he acted only for her ultimate welfare. The princess glanced across at Arjuna, who said, "O lotus-eyed lady, do not weep. What Krishna has said will come to pass. It cannot be otherwise." Standing by his sister's side, Drishtadyumna declared, "I shall slay Drona. Our brother Sikandi will kill Bhishma. Bhima will kill Duryodhan, and Arjuna will kill Karna, who offered you such unbearable offense in the Sabha. Dear sister, with Rama and Krishna's assistance, even Indra cannot conquer us. What then can be said of Dhritarashtra's sons?" All present now turned again toward Krishna. Looking at Yudhisthira, Krishna said, "O Lord of the earth, had I not been otherwise engaged at the time, I would have personally come to prevent the gambling match." By pointing out the evils associated with gambling, I would have gained the support of Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, and Balika. Between us, we would surely have swayed the blind king from his crooked purpose. The Brahmins present gathered around to hear Krishna speak, and he glanced at them with affection. Indulgence in illicit sex, gambling, and hunting, and intoxication are the four evils which beset men and deprive them of their prosperity. Gambling is particularly marked by the destruction of property, by misfortune, and by the squandering of wealth. It leads only to harsh words and enmity. Krishna said he would have pointed this out to Dhritarashtra, and if the king did not listen, he would have used force to bring him to his senses. And if anyone had supported the king in his ignorance, I would have destroyed them all. All this would surely have taken place, O king, if I had not been away from Dwarka at the time. It was only on my return that Satyaki informed me of the events in Hastinapur. Immediately upon receiving the news, I came here. My heart is pained to see you now, overtaken by calamity and sunk into misfortune. Yudhisthira asked Krishna where he had been during the gambling match. Krishna explained that he had gone to do battle with a king named Shalva, a friend of Shishupal. When Shalva heard that Krishna had killed Shishupal, he went to Dwarka and attacked the city while Krishna was in Indraprastha. Shalva owned a great airship, which resembled a flying city. He had received this wonderful airship as a gift from Lord Shiva. In battle, he used it as a base from which to attack his foes. Raining down weapons of every kind, he had challenged Krishna, not realizing that he was absent from Dwarka. After wreaking havoc in Dwarka, he had returned to his own city. Because Yudhisthira was interested, Krishna described in detail the fight that had taken place between Shalva and Dwarka's warriors. He then told the Pandava how, after returning to Dwarka and hearing of Shalva's attack, he had gone personally to fight with him. A terrible battle ensued. Shalva had acquired a great mystic power through his performance of asceticism. While he was fighting with Krishna, he created an illusion and seemingly killed Krishna's father, Vasudev, right on the battlefield. By his mystic power, Shalva also sent showers of arrows, clubs, winged darts, lances, thunderbolts, bullets, rockets, swords, axes, and other weapons down upon Krishna and his forces. In the end, Krishna killed Shalva and destroyed his airship with the Sudarshan Chakra. Krishna concluded his narration, "That is why, O Yudhisthira, I was unable to come to Hastinapur. The dice match took place just after I had slain Shalva and was engaged in restoring Dwarka back to its former condition. If I had come, Duryodhan would not now be alive, and the gambling match would never have taken place. What can I do now? It is difficult to stem the tide when the dam is broken. Krishna stood up to leave. He could do nothing for the Pandavas until the end of the 13 years. He knew that Yudhisthira and his brothers were too virtuous to break their word. They would doubtlessly remain in the forest for the full period. Krishna therefore told them that he would return to see them at the end of their exile. If Duryodhan did return their kingdom, he said, then he knew there would be a battle in which the Kaurava and his followers would be annihilated. The Pandavas bade Krishna and his party farewell, and Arjuna especially bid an affectionate goodbye to Subhadra and their young son Abhimanyu. Closely followed by Drishtadyumna and the other monarchs, Krishna left the forest on his golden chariot, which shone like the sun. As the thunderous sound of the chariot wheels died away into the distance, Yudhisthira ordered his brothers to make ready for their own departure. He wanted to enter more deeply into the Kamyaka forest and find a suitable place where they might spend their exile. Still accompanied by hundreds of Brahmins, the brothers made their way into the forest. After some time, they came to a great lake called Dvaitavana. Swans, chakravarkas, and other graceful birds swam in its waters, and the lake's edges were crowded with red, blue, and white lotuses, which were so fragrant that the air was heavy with their perfume. Numerous fruit trees, loaded with golden fruits, grew all around the lake. Peacocks, chakoras, cuckoos, and other birds, all singing beautiful songs, played in the trees. The brothers also saw many siddhas and charanas sporting in the woods and on the lake shore, and numberless rishis sitting motionless at the water's edge, their minds fixed upon the supreme Brahman. Yudhisthira was delighted. The area was beautiful. They would live there. The brothers rested beneath a large banyan tree, looking like five great elephants sitting by the side of a mountain. Domya then performed sacred rituals to sanctify the place where they would build their cottages, and then they began construction. Living in that forest, the Pandavas resembled a number of Indras amidst the celestials. They served the rishis and Brahmins by offering them excellent fruits and roots. Domya and other priests would perform daily sacrificial rites in honor of the gods and the Pandavas' ancestors. They thought constantly of Krishna and passed their time hearing the Brahmins recite Vedic texts. Soon after their arrival at Dvaitavana, the ageless rishi Markandeya visited them. It was said that Markandeya had lived since the dawn of creation and knew of everything that had occurred in the history of the universe. He greeted the Pandavas with affection and accepted their worship. The rishi, whose body was effulgent with spiritual light, and who appeared to be a youth of 16, smiled to see them. They reminded him of Rama and Lakshman, who had been exiled to the forest hundreds of thousands of years previously. The sage had also visited them. Since arriving in the forest, Yudhisthira had felt grief of what he had caused beginning to engulf him. Seeing Markandeya smiling, he asked, "O illustrious one, all the ascetics here are sorry to see our plight. How is it that you alone smile with delight?" "I am not delighted, my child. Rather, I am amazed at how much your situation resembles the life of Dasarath's son, Rama. He too suffered due to his unfailing truthfulness, and he too lived in the forest, exiled for some years. I remember seeing him thousands of years ago, wandering Mount Rishyamukha with his bow. Like you, Rama was high-souled and innocent, and like you, he lived in the forest out of filial obedience to his father. This is why I am smiling. No matter how powerful each of us may be, we cannot avoid the calamities that arrive through destiny. No one, therefore, should ever act unrighteously, thinking, 'I am powerful.' Markandeya then assured Yudhisthira that, like Ram, he would soon regain his kingdom from the Kauravas when his period of exile was over. After promising to come again while they were in the forest, he headed to the north. While the Pandavas dwelt at Dvaitavana, the air was constantly filled with the sound of Vedic recitations. The entire region was as holy as Brahma's abode. The sounds of mantras from the Yajur, Rig, and Samavedas, charming and delightful to the mind, were mingled with the twang of the Pandavas' bowstrings. They honed their martial arts skills by hunting dangerous forest animals. In accordance with scriptural codes, they maintained the population of tigers, boar, buffaloes, and other beasts in the Kamyaka forest, protecting the rishis from attack as they engaged in meditation and sacrifice. Yudhisthira loved the company of Brahmins. Now that he lived in their midst, his mind felt serene and his grief dissipated. All the world's greatest rishis had come to Dvaitavana to be with him. Narada, Vyasadeva, Vasishtha, Bhrigu, Angira, Kashyapa, and others. And they all worshipped Yudhisthira as the celestial sages worship Indra in heaven. Yudhisthira also returned their worship and spent his time discussing with them about spiritual topics. He was actually starting to enjoy forest life. In many ways, he found it preferable to the onerous and often harsh duties of being a king. The gentle son of Dharma was happy to live a simple life of spirituality, but he always kept in mind his God-given duty as a Kshatriya. That responsibility could not be whimsically abandoned. Even if unpleasant, duty must always be done for the Lord's pleasure. It was thus, with mixed feelings, that Yudhisthira dwelt in the forest, awaiting the day he could again resume his duties as a ruler. Draupadi, however, was still sorrowful. She found it difficult to reconcile the course of events that led up to their exile, and she burned with the humiliation that they had all received at Duryodhan's hands. Sitting alone one evening with Yudhisthira, she revealed her feelings. O King, when I think of the wicked Duryodhan and his followers living happily in Hastinapur, after having sent you to the forest, my heart burns. Without doubt, he is delighting in our misfortune. When you set out for the forest, all the Kurus cried, except the wretched Duryodhan, Karna, Shakuni, and that vicious Dushasan. Draupadi again found herself weeping. She remembered her parting words with Kunti and Gandhari. Both of them had grieved at her humiliation. How long would it be before she was avenged and the wrongdoers punished? Seeing you seated here on this grass mat, and remembering your ivory throne crusted with jewels, I feel such anguish that I can hardly look at you. Your body is smeared with mud from the river bank, when once it was daubed with the finest sandalwood paste. You once wore costly silk garments, and now you wear deerskins and tree bark. How can I bear to see my other husbands, who were once waited upon by numerous servants, now scouring the forest for food? Draupadi's sorrow suddenly turned to anger. All this is due to the evil schemes of sinful men. O King, does your plight not arouse anger in you? Why are you so peaceful? Look at Bhima glancing at you again and again. Constrained only by his love for you, he does not rise up and destroy the Kauravas. Honoring your promise, he sits containing his anger. Look to it, Arjuna. He understands Bhima's mind and is forever pacifying him. By the power of Arjuna's bow, thousands of kings were obliged to wait upon the Brahmins at Jarajasuya. Now that same Arjuna has become grief-stricken. Does this not make you angry? And look at Madri's youthful sons. They are as dear to you as they are to your mother Kunti, and now they are forced to live the hard lives of ascetics. Does this not make you angry? I cannot understand why you have not risen up to destroy the Kauravas. Surely after all that has happened, such a response would be in accord with morality. Is your discrimination failing? It is always appropriate for a Kshatriya to show anger when sin is committed, and sin has surely been committed by the Kauravas. How can you sit here as if you forgive them? If a king cannot distinguish between the time to be angry and the time to forgive, then he is lost. I also know the scripture. Scripture states that Duryodhan and his brothers deserve to be punished. Scripture states that the humble and ever-forgiving person is always neglected, while he who is powerful and assails others at the proper time is respected as a king. Yudhishthira looked with compassion upon his wife. She had suffered so much, and if anything stirred his heart, it was her suffering, for which he felt he had been the cause. Yet his heart still burned when he thought of how she was dragged into the assembly hall. The pain of that moment would stay with him the rest of his life. But this was not the time to make war. Draupadi could not understand the entire situation. He replied gently, "O intelligent lady, through anger we may sometimes gain wealth, but anger ultimately destroys mankind. Real prosperity crowns one who conquers anger and brings adversity to one whom anger controls. Anger is the root of all destruction. An angry man commits sin blindly. An angry man will kill even his preceptor and insult his elders. He cannot distinguish between right and wrong. There is nothing an angry man might not say or do, even to the point of sending himself to death's abode. Knowing this, I will not indulge in anger, Draupadi. Rather, I will strive to control it." Draupadi listened respectfully. She knew her husband's grasp of religion and morality was unsurpassed. He was capable of instructing even the gods. Sitting on a simple mat of kusha grass, Yudhishthira continued, "When a weak man is oppressed by one more powerful, he should not display anger, lest he bring about his own destruction. There are no blessed regions in the hereafter for those who destroy themselves. Thus the weak should always control their anger. Only fools praise anger, considering it equivalent to energy. The wise keep anger at a distance. The man consumed by anger does not easily acquire generosity, dignity, courage, skill, or the other attributes possessed by men of character. The wise consider him a man of character who restrains his wrath. The pious always praise such a man, because they understand that the forgiving man is always victorious. One who represses his anger, even when antagonized, rejoices in the next world. For this it is said that a wise man, whether strong or weak, and even if in difficulty, should always forgive his persecutor." By now Yudhishthira's brothers had gathered and were listening. Yudhishthira went on describing the glories of forgiveness. "If there were not persons in this world who exercise forgiveness, then chaos would soon prevail. If kings and other superiors give way to anger, then the distressed people will quickly meet with ruin. If inferiors do not tolerate their superiors' admonishments, then sin will take root and destroy mankind. I shall cite to you a verse spoken in ancient times by the Rishi Kashyapa. Forgiveness is virtue, forgiveness is sacrifice, and forgiveness is the Vedas. Forgiveness is purity and penance. It is truth, piety, religion, and the holy Narayan. Through forgiveness the universe is sustained, and by practicing forgiveness a man can attain to everlasting regions of bliss. How then can I renounce forgiveness, O Draupadi, in which is established spirituality, truth, wisdom, and the three worlds? Both this world and the next belong to the forgiving person. Therefore forgiveness is considered the highest virtue." Yudhishthira smiled at his wife. "Bhishma, Drona, Vidura, Kripa, and the other Kuru elders desire peace. Vyasadeva and the other rishis also praise peace, Panchali. Therefore let us first try for a peaceful settlement. If Dhritarashtra yields to temptation and does not return our kingdom, then the Bharata race will be destroyed. But let me not be the cause, princess. Forgiveness and humility both of which are unknown to Duryodhan, are the qualities of the self-controlled. They constitute eternal virtue. I shall therefore adopt them. Draupadi was still doubtful. If virtue conferred victory and success on a man, then how could Yudhisthira have undergone such a calamity? He had never strayed from virtue at any time. Even during the gambling match, he acted only with virtuous intentions. Now he was cast into misfortune, while the sinful Duryodhan enjoyed prosperity. The princess said, "It seems to me, O king, that although you always protect virtue, virtue has not protected you. Even the celestials know that you live only by virtue. I am sure you would abandon me and your brothers before abandoning virtue. You serve the Brahmins with everything you possess. You never disregard your elders, equals, or even inferiors. Although you conquered the earth, you did not become proud. You have performed great sacrifices and given unlimited charity. Even now, while living a life of hardship in this forest, your virtue has suffered no diminishment." Draupadi looked at her husband in the eyes as she made her point. "Despite all this, still your intelligence was perverted by destiny, and you gambled away everything. Your wealth, kingdom, brothers, even me. How could one like you, who are simple, gentle, modest, liberal, and truthful, be drawn to gambling? Gambling is a vice. I just cannot understand how it is possible." Although Draupadi understood that everything was under the control of the Supreme Lord, she felt her faith challenged by Yudhisthira's seemingly inexplicable situation. "Surely, O king, all creatures are made to act by the Lord, even as a puppet is moved by its controller. No one can pass a moment independently. God ordains our happiness and distress in accord with the results of our past actions. Everyone depends upon the Lord. He brings us together and uses us as instruments to fulfill each other's karma. It thus seems to me that it is the Lord who has brought about your calamity. But how has he sanctioned such injustice, so contrary to the ways of virtue and truth? And if he is not to blame, then it means that the controlling principle is who has the most power. If actions are not bound with God-given consequences, then I lament for those who are not powerful." Yudhisthira could see that his wife was bewildered by grief and sorrow. "O gentle lady born from sacrifice, although your speech is sweet and well articulated, it is atheistic. No one should ever perform virtue with a desire to gain its fruits. Such a sinful traitor of virtue will never reap the results. I practice virtue only because I desire to follow the Vedas and satisfy the Lord. The Vedas state that he who doubts virtue is destined to be born among the brutes. He who doubts religion, virtue, and the words of the rishis is excluded from the religions of immortality and bliss. Such a person is considered lower than a thief." Draupadi bowed her head as her husband continued, "O thin-waisted lady, you have seen with your own eyes the results of virtue in such immortal sages as Markandeya, Vyasadeva, Maitreya, and the celestial sage Narada. All these shining and ever-blissful rishis describe virtue as the foremost duty. If the pieties practiced by the virtuous bore no fruits, then this world long ago would have been covered by darkness. None would have pursued liberation, nor cared to acquire knowledge or even wealth. All men would have lived like beasts, and this world would be thrown into confusion." The Brahmins, who had by now also come to hear Yudhisthira's speech, nodded in agreement. Darkness had set in, and fires now burned in the great clearing where they sat. Draupadi could hear the flames crackling, as well as the sounds of crickets, as Yudhisthira continued. "Do not doubt virtue because you do not see its results, Panchali. Without doubt, the fruits will manifest in time, as will the fruits of sin. The fruits of true virtue are eternal and indestructible, leading one to the highest regions of happiness. Therefore, do not speak ill of God. Try to understand the Supreme Being and His desires. O Draupadi, always bow to Him. This will be for your own good. Tears fell from Draupadi's eyes. She knew her husband's words were true. Surely God was infallible, and always the well-wishing friend of all living beings. But who could understand God? His activities were inscrutable. No one can understand His plans. The apparent reversal of the virtuous Pandavas, and even that the reversal had seemingly come through Yudhisthira's own inexplicable actions, was incomprehensible and quite incredible. Draupadi sighed, "I will accept what you have said, O best of men. The Lord is certainly bestowing upon all beings the fruits of their own work. Even if some sudden calamity or good fortune befalls us, we must understand it to be the result of some action in a former life. But besides destiny, there is exertion. A man who does not exert himself will eventually be ruined. I feel you should exert yourself now to recover your kingdom. Even if you fail, you will at least have satisfied everyone that you did all that human endeavor can accomplish. Although the results are not in our hands, we should still perform our work. The wise always condemn inaction. Why then do you remain inactive? This is my doubt." Draupadi fell silent. Then, stirred by her words, Bhima felt impelled to speak. He too was angry, and found the forest almost unbearable. It was not the austerity he minded, but the thought of Duryodhan and his brothers enjoying their ill-gotten gains. Why did Yudhisthira suffer in silence? Draupadi was right. It was time for them to act. Bhima burst out, "O Yudhisthira, what do you hope to gain by living like an ascetic? You are not a yogi, but a king. You should walk the path of kings. Duryodhan robbed you of your kingdom. He is like a weak, offal-eating jackal, stealing the prey of lions. How do you tolerate it? How can you abandon the wealth that was both our source of virtue and pleasure in exchange for this trifling virtue called keeping your promise? Surely you fail to see what is of true value." Yudhisthira remained calm while Bhima vented his long pent-up anger. The forest reverberated with his words, his voice as deep and powerful as a kettle drum. "O king, it was only due to your carelessness that we lost our kingdom. Only to please you did we allow Duryodhan and his brothers to wrest from us our wealth and afflict us with such pain. On your command we now pain our friends and enliven our enemies. Surely it was folly that we did not kill the Kauravas then and there. Indeed, we have meekly come to the forest and act worthy only of weak men. Krishna does not approve, nor does Arjuna, the twins, or myself. O king, has your despair led you to lose your manliness on the plea of virtue? Only cowards cherish despair, being unable to win back what they have lost." Bhima argued that so-called virtue, which produced calamity, was not virtue at all. What use was virtue for its own sake? Kings should practice virtue to make their kingdoms prosperous and to achieve pleasure. All three things, virtue, profit, and pleasure, should be pursued equally. None of them should be sought at the cost of the others. Have you lost sight of your proper duty? You are a powerful warrior, supported by other powerful men. Use that power to regain your rightful kingdom. When you have established your rule, then acquire religious merit by ruling piously and giving charity to the Brahmins. By giving up this promise to stay in the forest, you will be casting aside an inferior principle for the greater good. Bhima softened. The Brahmins and the people want you to rule them. They all despise Duryodhan. You are capable of taking back your kingdom. and you have Arjuna and myself to help you. Who can withstand us in battle? Let us use strategy and strength to win back what is ours. This is our duty." Yudhisthira remained silent for some moments as he summoned patience. He looked up at Bhima. "O descendant of Bharata, I cannot reproach you for giving me pain with your arrow-like words. It is true that due to my folly, I have brought this calamity upon us. I knew I could not defeat Shakuni at dice, yet I allowed myself to be drawn into the game. I should have exerted greater control over myself. O Bhima, the mind cannot be controlled when it comes under the influence of manliness, pride, and prowess. I do not censure you for what you have said, but I do consider what has happened to us to be preordained." Yudhisthira made it clear that he would not break his promise. "Do you recall the conditions of the final dice game?" Shakuni said, "He who loses this game shall go to the forest and remain there for 13 years. The winner shall take his kingdom and return it when the forest term has expired." I then uttered, "So be it." Yudhisthira hung his head and fell silent as he remembered that day. What had overcome him? He had thought he was acting only for virtue, but as a result, all his loved ones had suffered. Still, he was resolute. No matter how painful their present situation, there was no turning back. He would not abandon his promise. The agreement would be kept. Yudhisthira was firm. "How then, O Bhima, shall I now falsify my word for the sake of wealth? To me nothing is greater than truth. For a respectable person, it is better to die than to transgress his word. Let us pass our days here in peace. Better days will come. A farmer scatters seeds and awaits the harvest. In the same way, virtue and truth always bring results in time. Do not doubt this principle." Bhima was not convinced. His heart was too full of anger. He had not even been able to sleep since coming to the forest. Neither could he face the prospect of waiting so many years before he could vent his rage on the Kauravas. What virtue had they ever observed? Why then should Yudhisthira treat them as honorable? Did he think they respected his virtue and adherence to the truth? They saw him as weak and were laughing at him. If only Yudhisthira would see sense and order them to gear up for battle. Bhima tried again to convince him. "O great king, how can any mortal make a promise that is dependent on the passage of time? No one knows when his life will end. We have now been in the forest for 13 months. Let that be our 13 years. Indeed, the Vedas state that in certain circumstances a month can substitute for a year. Let us go now and crush our enemies. Even if we were to go to hell on that day, that hell will feel like heaven. Although only Draupadi and I have revealed our hearts to you on this matter, Arjuna, the twins, Kunti, and our many allies share the same feelings. Only because they seek to please you do they remain silent. It is only weakness that forces you to adhere to your pledge, dear brother. No one is praising you for your kindly disposition toward our enemies." Bhima stood silhouetted by the fire. His huge frame resembled a blazing mountain. "O king, although remaining fixed in virtue, you still cannot see the truth, like an ignorant man who has memorized the Vedas without knowing their meaning. You are a Kshatriya, yet you act like a Brahmin. A king's duties are fraught with crookedness and cunning. You know this well." Bhima had another concern. How would they be able to live incognito for the 13th year? They were known throughout the world, and Duryodhan had many supporters. Numerous kings who had been subjugated by the Pandavas at the time of the Rajasuya now back the Kauravas. Duryodhan would have his spies looking for them everywhere. Bound by Yudhisthira's promise, they would be living in the forest forever. Force would be the only way out, sooner or later. Bhima implored Yudhisthira, "Please give the order for battle, O hero. There is no higher duty for a Kshatriya. Even if there be any sin in this course, then you can counteract it later by sacrifice and charity." Yudhisthira sighed again, but did not speak. Bhima was overcome by passion, he thought, and not thinking carefully. Could he not understand that their suffering had been somehow ordained by the Supreme Lord? All they could do now was follow their religious duties as prescribed by God, leaving the results in his hands. They could not please the Lord by abandoning religion, and to please God was always everyone's prime duty. Surely Bhima knew that. But there was another consideration. Yudhisthira's voice was calm as he explained his mind to Bhima. "O mighty armed hero, when a man performs sinful deeds depending upon his own power, such deeds become only a source of pain for him. But if he reflects carefully before action, he will attain success. Listen as I tell you what is likely to happen if we follow your suggestion, born as it is of pride and mental unrest." Yudhisthira then listed the many kings allied with Duryodhan. There was Bhishma, Drona, and Kripa. Out of obligation, they would certainly side with Duryodhan. Then there was Ashvatthama, Karna, Valika, Burishrava, and Duryodhan's brothers. There were hundreds of other kings who would fight alongside the Kauravas because they had previously been defeated by the Pandavas. Duryodhan's treasury was full, especially as he now had control of Indraprastha. He could easily and quickly amass a vast army. On the other hand, the Pandavas had no position, no wealth, no army, and only a few allies. Duryodhan's forces are virtually unassailable. The Kuru chiefs are masters of the celestial weapons. I doubt that even Indra and all the gods could vanquish them. I especially fear Karna, who is impetuous, angry, invincible, and accomplished in every weapon, and encased in impenetrable armor. Yudhisthira remembered how Karna had been born with a natural coat of armor on his body. Although he appeared to be a charioteer's son, it was obvious that his origin was in some way divine. For some reason he harbored a deep envy of Arjuna. One day, Yudhisthira knew, Karna and Arjuna would wage a great battle to settle their enmity. The skirmish at Draupadi's Swayamvara had been nothing. Karna had not wanted to exert himself against what he thought was a Brahmin. But if he displayed his full power, then who could be sure that Arjuna would be able to defeat him? Thinking of Karna and the danger he poses, I cannot sleep at night. Without overcoming him, as well as all the other heroes I have mentioned, we will not be able to defeat Duryodhan. O best of men, consider all this carefully. Hearing his brother's admonition, Bhima became pensive. Yudhisthira was right, of course, and he could not argue with him. Although Bhishma, Drona, and Kripa, and the other kings in Hastinapur had always been their friends and well-wishers, it was different now. If it came to war, they would surely side with the Kauravas. The thought of fighting against those invincible heroes was daunting, especially because he felt so much affection for them. Bhima sat down, defeated. As the Pandavas sat together in silence, Vyasadeva appeared out of the forest. They quickly stood up and bowed before the Rishi. After taking a seat among them, the Rishi said to Yudhisthira, "O mighty armed one, I have divined your thoughts. I wish to help you, and therefore I have come. I will destroy the fever in your mind by telling you how to defeat Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, Karna, Duryodhan, and all his followers. Listen carefully." Vyasadeva then took Yudhisthira aside and spoke to him in private. He taught him the mystical skill called Pratishmriti, and then instructed him to teach the same skill to Arjuna. This skill allowed the practitioner to travel great distances in a short time. Thus Arjuna could go to the Himalayas, approach the gods, and receive from them their special weapons. Due to his asceticism and prowess, he is quite capable of approaching the celestials, Vyasadeva said. Indeed, he is Narayan's eternal associate. Indra, Rudra, and all the principal gods will surely bestow their weapons upon Arjuna, and he will perform tremendous deeds by receiving them. After giving Yudhisthira the Pratishmriti mantras, Vyasadeva left. Just before leaving, he also told Yudhisthira to move to a different forest. Otherwise, the brothers might disturb the animal population in the Dvaitavana forest by hunting them excessively. Having lived there more than a year, they had killed many deer, tigers, boar, and other wild animals. Accompanied by the Brahmins whom they were supporting, Yudhisthira and his brothers moved to another part of the great Kamyaka forest, this time on the banks of the river Saraswati.